you'll be staying?
We weren't able to make hotel arrangements, Clerk replied. We'll check the local hotels.
Good luck, the official didn't say. This idea had come off half-baked, and every hotel room on Saipan, he was sure, was already filled.
Well, that wasn't his problem.
Can we rent a car?
Yes, over that way, the man pointed. The older Russian looked nervous, he thought.
You're late.
Well, sorry about that, Oreza replied tersely. There's nothing new happening at all.
Well, maybe the fighters are a little more active, but not much, and they've been pretty busy anyway.
You're going to get some company soon, the National Military Command Center told him.
Who?
Two reporters. They have some questions for you, was the answer, because of the renewed concern for Oreza's secure status.
When?
Any time, probably today.
Everything okay with you, Chief?
Master Chief, you turkey, Portugee didn't say.
Just great. We saw part of the President's speech, and we're a little worried because the missile site is so close to us, and
you'll have enough warning. Does your house have a basement? The voice asked.
No, it doesn't.
Well, that's okay. We'll let you know. Okay?
Sure, sir.
Out.
Does your house have a basement?
No.
Well, that's okay.
If it's okay, why'd you ask, goddammit?
Oreza deactivated the phone after taking it out of the mixing bowl and walked to the window. Two eagles were taking off. Such a mechanical thing to watch. Something was happening. He didn't know what. Perhaps their pilots didn't either, but you couldn't tell what they were thinking from looking at their aircraft.
Shiro Sato reefed his F-15J into a right turn to clear the civilian air traffic. If the Americans attacked, they would do it as the attacks on the home islands had come, off island bases, supported by tankers from a long way off. Wake was a possibility, and so were a few other islands. He'd face aircraft not unlike his own. They would have airborne radar support, and so would he. It would be a fair fight unless the bastards brought down their stealth aircraft. Damn the things. Damn their ability to defeat the commies. But the Americans had only a few of them, and if they flew in daylight, he'd take his chances. At least there would be no real surprises. There was a huge air defense radar on Saipan's highest point, and with the squadrons based on Guam, this would be a real fight, he told himself, climbing up to patrol altitude.
So, what's the big deal? Chavez asked, playing with a map.
You wouldn't believe it if I told you.
Well, take the next left, I think, by Lazama's Mobile.
Chavez looked up from the map. There were soldiers everywhere, and they were digging in, something they ought to have done sooner, he thought.
Is that a Patriot battery?
Sure looks like one to me.
How the hell am I going to handle this? Clark asked himself, finding the last turn and heading into the cul-de-sac.
The house number was the one he'd memorized. He pulled into the driveway and got out, heading for the front door. Oreza had been in the bathroom finishing a needed shower while Burroughs handled the running count on the aircraft in and out of Kobler when the doorbell rang.
"Who are you?"
"Didn't they tell you?" Clark asked, looking around.
"Who the hell was this guy?"
"Reporters, right?"
"Yeah, that's it."
"Okay." Burroughs opened the door with a look up and down the street.
"Who are you, anyway? I thought this was the house of—"
"You're dead!" Oreza was standing in the hall, wearing just khaki shorts, his chest a mass of hair as thick as the remaining jungle on the island. The hair looked especially dark now, with the rest of the man's skin turning rapidly to the color of milk.
"You're fucking dead!"
"Hi, Portugee." Clerk, Clark, Kelly said with a smile.
"Long time."
He couldn't make himself move.
"I saw you die. I went to the goddamn memorial service. I was there."
"Hey, I know you," Chavez said. "You were on the boat our chopper landed on. What the hell is this? You agency?"
It was almost too much for Oreza. He didn't remember the little one at all, but the big one, the old one, his age, about, was...
Couldn't be. Was. It wasn't possible. Was it? John, he asked after a few seconds of further incredulity. It was too much for the man who used to be known as John Kelly. He set his bag down and came over to embrace the man, surprised by the tears in his eyes. Yeah, Portigee, it's me. How you doing, man? But how? At the memorial service, did they use the line about sure and certain hope that the sea will give up its dead? He paused, then he had to grin. Well, it did. Oreza closed his eyes, thinking back over 20 years. Those two admirals, right? You got it. So, what the hell are you been... CIA, man. They decided they need somebody who could... Well, I remember that, Pat. He really hadn't changed all that much. Older, but the same hair and the same eyes, warm and open to him as they'd always been, Portigee thought. But underneath, always the hint of something else, like an animal in a cage, but an animal who knew how to pick the lock whenever he wanted. I hear you've been doing okay for a retired coastie. Come on, Master Chief, the man shook his head. The past could wait. What's going on? Well, we've been out of the loop for a few hours. Anything new that you know? The president was on. They cut him off, but... Did they really have nukes? Burroughs asked. Did? Ding asked. We got him? That's what he said. Who the hell are you, by the way? Oreza wanted to know. Domingo Chavez, the young man extended his hand. I see you and Mr. C know each other. I go by Clark now, John explained. It was odd how good it felt to talk with a man who knew his real name. Does he know? John shook his head. Not many people know. Most of them are dead. Admiral Maxwell and Admiral Greer both. Too bad. They saved my ass. Oreza turned to his other new guest. Tough luck, kid. It's some fucking sea story. You still drink beer, John? Especially if it's free, Chavez confirmed. Don't you see? It's finished now. Who else did they get? Yamata asked. Matsuda Itagaki. They got every patron of every minister, all except you and me, Murakami said, not adding that they had nearly gotten him. Raizo, it's time to put an end to this. Call Goto and tell him to negotiate a peace. I will not, Yamata snarled back. Don't you see? Our missiles are destroyed, and we can make new ones. We have the ability to make more warheads, and we have more missiles at Yoshinobu. If we attempt that, you know what the Americans will do, you fool. They wouldn't dare. You told us that they could not repair the damage you did to their financial systems. You told us that our air defenses were invincible. You told us that they could never strike back at us effectively. Murakami paused for a breath. You told us all these things, and you were wrong. Now I am the last one to whom you may speak, and I am not listening. You tell Goto to make peace. They'll never take these islands back. Never. They do not have the ability. Say what you please, Raizo-chan. For my part, it is over. Find a good place to hide, then. Yamato would have slammed the phone down, but a portable didn't offer that option. Murder us, he muttered. It had taken most of the morning to assemble the necessary information. Somehow the Americans had struck at his own council of Zaibatsu. How? Nobody knew. Somehow they'd penetrated the defenses that every consultant had told him were invincible, even to the point of destroying the intercontinental missiles. How? He asked. It would seem that we underestimated the quality of their remaining air forces, General Orima replied with a shrug. It is not the end. We still have options. Oh, not everyone was giving up then. They will not wish to invade these islands. Their ability to perform a proper invasion is severely compromised by their lack of amphibious assault ships, and even if they managed to put people on the island to fight amidst so many of their own citizens, no,
Arima shook his head. They will not risk it. They will seek a negotiated peace. There is still a chance, if not for complete success, then for a negotiated peace that leaves our forces largely intact. Yamata accepted that for what it was. Looking out the windows at the island that he wanted to be his. The elections, he thought, could still be won. It was the political will of the Americans that needed attacking, and he still had the ability to do that. It didn't take long to turn the 747 around, but the surprise to Captain Sato was that the aircraft was half full for the flight back to Narita. 30 minutes after liftoff, a stewardess reported to him by phone that of the 11 people she'd asked, all but two said that they had pressing business that required their presence at home. What pressing business might that be, he wondered, with his country's international trade for the most part reduced to ships traveling between Japan and China. This is not turning out well, his co-pilot observed an hour out. Look down there. It was easy to spot ships from 30,000 feet, and of late they'd taken to carrying binoculars to identify surface ships. Sato lifted his pair and spotted the distinctive shapes of Aegis destroyers still heading north. On a whim, he reached down to flip his radio to a different guard frequency.
JAL-747 calling Mutsu. Over.
Who is this? A voice instantly replied. Clear this frequency at once.
This is Captain Torajiro Sato. Call your fleet commander, he ordered, with his own command voice.
It took a minute.
"Brother, you shouldn't be doing this," Yusuo chided. Radio silence was as much a formality as a real military necessity. He knew that the Americans had reconnaissance satellites, and besides, his group's spy radars were all up and radiating. If American snooper aircraft were about, they'd know where his squadron was. It was something he would have considered with confidence a week before, but not now.
"I merely wanted to express our confidence in you and your men. Use us for a practice target," he added. In Mutsu's CIC, the missile techs were already doing exactly that, but it wouldn't do to say so, the admiral knew.
"Good to hear your voice again. Now, you must excuse me. I have work to do here."
"Understood, Yusuo. Out." Sato took his finger off the radio switch.
"See," he said over the intercom. "They're doing their job, and we have to do ours."
The co-pilot wasn't so sure, but Sato was the captain of the 747, and he kept his peace, concentrating on navigational tasks. Like most Japanese, he'd been raised to think of war as something to be avoided as assiduously as plague. The overnight development of a conflict with America, well, it had felt good for a day or so to teach the arrogant Gaijin a lesson, but that was fantasy talking, and this was increasingly real. Then the double-barreled notification that his country had fielded nuclear arms, that was madness enough, only immediately to be followed by the American claim that the weapons had been destroyed. This was an American aircraft, after all, a Boeing 747-400 Pip, 5 years old, but state-of-the-art in every respect, reliable and steady. There was little America had to learn about the building of aircraft, and if this one was as good as he knew it to be, then how much more formidable still were their military aircraft? The aircraft his country's Air Force flew were copies of American designs, except for the AEW-767s he'd heard so much about, first about how invincible they were, and more recently, about how there were only a few left. This madness had to stop. Didn't everyone see that? Some must, he thought, else why was his airliner half full of people who didn't want to be on Saipan, despite their earlier enthusiasm? But his captain did not see that at all, did he? The co-pilot asked himself. Torajiro Sato was sitting there, fixed as stone in the left seat, as though all were normal, when plainly it was not. All he had to do was look down in the afternoon sunlight to see those destroyers. Doing what? They were guarding their country's coast against the possibility of attack. Was that normal?
Khan, sonar.
Khan, aye.
Claggett had the con for the afternoon watch. He wanted the crew to see him at work, and more than that, wanted to keep the feel for conning his boat.
Possible multiple contacts to the south, the sonar chief reported. Bearing 171. Look like surface ships at high speed, sir, getting pounding, and a very high blade rate.
That was about right, the CO thought, heading for the sonar room again. He was about to order a track to be plotted, but when he turned to do so, he saw two quartermasters already setting it up and the raypath analyzer printing its first cut on the range. His crew was fully drilled in now, and things just happened automatically, but better. They were thinking as well as acting.
Best guess they're a ways off, but look at all this, the chief said. It was clearly a real contact. Data was appearing on four different frequency lines. Then the chief held up his phones.
Sounds like a whole bunch of screws turning, a lot of racing and cavitation. Has to be multiple ships, traveling in column.
And our other friend? Claggett asked. The sub? He's gone quiet again, probably just tooling along on batteries at five or less.
That contact was a good 20 miles off, just beyond the usual detection range.
Sir, initial range cut on the new contacts is 100+ thousand yards CZ contact, another tech reported.
Bearing is constant, not a wiggle.
They heading straight for us, sir, close to it. They pounded hard.
What are surface conditions like, sir?
Waves 8 to 10 feet, chief.
100,000 yards plus, more than 50 nautical miles, Claggett thought.
Those ships were driving hard, right to him, but he wasn't supposed to shoot.
Damn.
He took the required 3 steps back into control.
Right, 10 degrees, rudder, come to new course, 270.
Tennessee came about to a westerly heading, the better to give her sonar operators a range for the approaching destroyers. His last piece of operational intelligence had predicted this, and the timing of the information was as accurate as it was unwelcome. In a more dramatic setting in front of cameras, the atmosphere might have been different. But although the setting was dramatic in a distant sense, right now it was merely cold and miserable. Though these men were the most elite of troops, it was far easier to rouse yourself for combat against a person than against unremitting environmental discomfort. The Rangers, in their mainly white camouflage overclothing, moved about as little as possible, and the lack of physical activity merely made them more vulnerable to the cold and to boredom, the soldiers' deadliest enemy. And yet that was good, Captain Chaker thought. For a single squad of soldiers 4,000 miles from the nearest U.S. Army base, and that base was Fort Wainwright in Alaska, it was a hell of a lot safer to be bored than to be excited by the stimulus of a combat action without any hope of support, or something like that. Chaker faced the problem common to officers. Subject to the same discomfort and misery as his men, he was not allowed to bitch. There was no other officer to bitch to in any case, and to do so in front of the men was bad for morale, even though the men probably would have understood.
"Be nice to get back to Fort Stewart, sir," First Sergeant Vega observed. "Spread on that sunblock and catch some rays on the beach."
"And miss all this beautiful snow and sleet, oh so?"
At least the sky was clear now.
"Rajo, Captain. But I got my fill of this shit when I was a kid in Chicago."
He paused, looking and listening round again. The noise discipline of the other Rangers was excellent, and you had to look very closely indeed to see where the lookouts were standing.
"Ready for the walkout tonight?"
"Just so's our friend is waiting on the far side of that hill."
"I'm sure he will be," Chaker lied.
"Yes, sir. I am, too."
If one could do it, why not two, Vega thought.
Did all this stuff work?
The killers in their midst were sleeping in their bags in holes lined with pine branches and covered with more branches for additional warmth. In addition to guarding the pilots, the Rangers had to keep them healthy, like watching over infants, an odd mission for elite troops, but troops of that sort generally drew the oddest.
"So they say," Chaker looked at his watch.
"We shake them loose in another 2 hours."
Vega nodded, hoping that his legs weren't too stiff for the trek south. The patrol pattern had been set in the mission briefing. The four boomers had 30-mile sectors, and each sector was divided into three 10-mile segments. Each boat could patrol in the center slot, leaving the north and south slots empty for everything but weapons. The patrol patterns were left to the judgment of individual skippers, but they worked out the same way. Pennsylvania was on a northerly course, trolling along at a mere 5 knots, just as she'd done for her now-ended deterrence patrols, carrying Trident missiles. She was making so little noise that a whale might have come close to a collision if it were the right time for whales in this part of the Pacific, which it wasn't. Behind her, at the end of a lengthy cable, was her towed array sonar, and the 2-hour north-south cycle allowed it to trail straight out in a line, with about 10 minutes or so required for the turns at the end of the cycles to get it straight again for maximum performance. Pennsylvania was at 600 feet, the ideal sonar depth given today's water conditions. It was just sunset up on the roof when the first trace appeared on her sonar screens. It started as a series of dots, yellow on the video screen, trickling down slowly with time, and shifting a little to the south in bearing, but not much. Probably, the lead sonar man thought, the target had been running on battery for the past few hours, else he would have caught the louder signals of the diesels used to charge them. But there the contact was on the expected 60 hertz line. He reported the contact data to the fire control tracking party. Wasn't this something, the sonar man thought. He'd spent his entire career in missile boats, so often tracking contacts which his submarine would maneuver to avoid, even though the boomer fleet prided itself on having the best torpedo men in the fleet. Pennsylvania carried only 15 weapons aboard. There was a shortage of the newest version of the ADCAP torpedo, and it had been decided not to bother carrying anything less capable under the circumstances. It also had 3 other torpedo-like units called LEMOSes for Long Endurance Mobile Submarine Simulator. The skipper, another lifelong boomer sailor, had briefed the crew on his intended method of attack, and everyone aboard approved. The mission, in fact, was just about ideal. The Japanese had to move through their line. Their operational pattern was such that for them to pass undetected through the line of battle, as the skipper had taken to calling it, was most unlikely. "Now hear this," the captain said over the 1MC announcing system. Every speaker had been turned down so that the announcement came as a whisper that the men strained to hear. "We have a probable submerged contact in our kill zone. I'm going to conduct the attack just as we briefed it. Battle stations," he concluded in the voice of a man ordering breakfast at Hojo's. There came sounds so faint that only one experienced sonar man could hear them, and that mostly because he was just forward of the attack center. The watch had changed there so that only the most experienced men and one woman now would occupy the weapons consoles. Those people too junior for a place on the sub's varsity assembled throughout the boat in damage control parties. Voices announced to the attack center talker that each space was fully manned and ready, and then the ship grew as silent as a graveyard on Halloween. "Contact is firming up nicely," the sonar man said over his phones. "Bearing is changing westerly. Bearing to target now 075, getting a faint blade rate on the contact. Estimate contact speed is 10 knots. That made it a definite submarine, not that there was much doubt. The diesel sub had her own towed array sonar and was doing a sprint and drift of her own, alternately going at her top speed, then slowing to detect anything that she might miss with the increased flow noise. "Tubes 1, 3, and 4 are ADCAPs," a weapons technician announced. "Tube 2 is a LEMOS." "Spin them all up," the captain said. Most COs like to say warm them up, but otherwise this one was by the book. "Current range estimate is 22,000 yards, the tracking party chief announced. The sonar man saw something new on his screen, then adjusted his headphones. "Transient. Transient sounds like hull popping on Sierra 10. Contact is changing depth." "Going up, I'd bet," the captain said a few feet away. "That's about right," the sonar man thought with a nod of his own. "Let's get the moss in the water. Set its course at 000. Keep it quiet for the first 10,000 yards, then up to normal radiating levels." "Aye, sir."
The tech dialed in the proper settings on her programming board, and then the weapons officer checked the instructions and pronounced them correct.
Ready on two. Contact Sierra 10 is fading somewhat, sir, probably above the layer now.
Definite direct path to Sierra 10, the Raypath technician said next.
Definitely not a CZ contact, sir.
Ready on the tube, the weapons tech reported again.
Fire two, the CO ordered at once. Reload another MOS, he said next.
Pennsylvania shuddered ever so slightly as the Lemos was ejected into the sea. The sonar picked it up at once as it angled left, then reversed course, heading north at a mere 10 knots. Based on an old Mark 48 torpedo body, the Lemos was essentially a huge tank of the autofuel American fish used, plus a small propulsion system and a large sound transducer that gave out the noise of an engine plant. The noise was the same frequency as those of a nuclear power plant, but quite a bit louder than those on an Ohio class. It never seemed to matter to people that the thing was too loud. Attack submarines almost always went for it, even American ones who should have known better. The new model with the new name could move along for over 15 hours, and it was a shame it had been developed only a few months before the boomers had been fully and finally disarmed. Now came the time for patience. The Japanese submarine actually slowed a little more, doubtless doing its own final sonar sweep before they lit off the diesels for their speedy passage west. The sonar man tracked the Lemos north. The signal was just about to fade out completely before the sound systems turned on 5 miles away. 2 miles after that, it jumped over the thermocline layer of cold and warm water, and the game began in earnest.
Con, sonar, Sierra 10 just changed speed, change in the blade rate. Slowing down, sir.
He has good sonar, the captain said, just behind the sonar man. Pennsylvania had risen somewhat, floating her sonar tail over the layer for a better look at the contact, while the body of the submarine stayed below. He turned and spoke more loudly.
Weapons.
1, 3, and 4 are ready for launch. Solutions on all of them.
Set 4 for a stalking profile. Initial course 020.
Done. Set as ordered, sir. Tube 4 ready in all respects.
Match bearings and shoot, the captain ordered from the door of the sonar room, adding, reload another ADCAP.
Pennsylvania shuddered again as the newest version of the venerable Mark 48 torpedo entered the sea, turning northeast and controlled by an insulated wire that streamed out from its tail fin. This was like an exercise, the sonar man thought, but easier.
Additional contacts, the skipper asked, behind him again.
Not a thing, sir.
The enlisted man waved at his scopes. Only random noise showed, and an additional scope was running diagnostic checks every 10 minutes to show that the systems were all functioning properly. It was quite a payoff. After nearly 40 years of missile boat operations and close to 50 of nuclear sub-ops, the first American sub-kill since World War II would come from a boomer supposedly on her way to the scrapyard. Traveling far more rapidly, the ADCAP torpedo popped over the layer somewhat aft of the contact. It immediately started radiating from its own ultrasonic sonar and fed the picture back along the wire to Pennsylvania.
Hard contact, range 3,000 and close to the surface. Looking good, sonar said.
The same diagnosis came from the weapons petty officer with her identical readout.
Eat shit and die, the male member of the team whispered, watching the two contact lines close on the display.
Sierra 10 went instantly to full speed, diving at first below the layer, but his batteries were probably a little low and he didn't make more than 15 knots, while the ADCAP was doing over 60. The one-sided chase lasted a total of 3.5 minutes and ended with a bright splotch on the screen and a noise in the headphones that stung his ears. The rest was epilogue, concluding with a ripping screech of steel being crushed by water pressure.
That's a kill, sir. I copy a definite kill.
2 minutes later, a distant low frequency to the north suggested that West Virginia had achieved the same goal.
Christopher Cook? Murray asked.
That's right.
It was a very nice house, the deputy assistant director thought as he pulled out his identification folder.
FBI,
We'd like to talk to you about your conversations with Seiji Nagumo. Could you get a coat? The sun had a few more hours to go when the Lancers taxied out. Angered by the loss of one of their number not so long before, the crews deemed themselves to be in the wrong place doing the wrong thing, but nobody had troubled himself to ask their opinion, and their job was written down. Their bomb bays taken up with fuel tanks, one by one the bombers raced down the runway and lifted off, turning and climbing to their assembly altitude of 20,000 feet for the crews northeast. It was another goddamn demonstration, Dubrow thought, and he wondered how the hell somebody like Robbie Jackson could have thought it up. But he, too, had orders, and each of his carriers turned into the wind 50 miles apart to launch 40 aircraft each, and though these were all armed, they were not to take action unless provoked. Chapter 46 Detachment. We're almost empty, the co-pilot said in a neutral voice, checking the manifest as part of the pre-flight ritual.
What is the matter with these people? Captain Sato growled, looking over the flight plan and checking the weather.
That was a short task. It would be cool and clear all the way down, with a huge high-pressure area taking charge of the western Pacific. Except for some high winds in the vicinity of the home islands, it would make for a glassy, smooth ride all the way to Saipan, for the 34 passengers on the flight. 34, he raged, in an aircraft built for over 300.
Captain, we will be leaving those islands soon, you know that.
It was clear enough, wasn't it? The people, the average men and women on the street, were no longer so much confused as frightened, or maybe even that wasn't the proper word. He hadn't seen anything like it. They felt betrayed. The first newspaper editorials had come out to question the course their country had taken, and though the questions asked were mild, the import of them was not. It had all been an illusion. His country had not been prepared for war in a psychological sense any more than a physical one, and the people were suddenly realizing what was actually going on. The whispered reports of the murder, what else could one call it, of some prominent Zaibatsu had left the government in a turmoil. Prime Minister Goto was doing little, not even giving speeches, not even making appearances, lest he have to face questions for which he had no answers. But the faith of his captain, the co-pilot saw, had not yet been shaken.
No, we will not. How can you say that? Those islands are ours.
Time will tell, the co-pilot observed, returning to his work and letting it go at that. He did have his job to do, rechecking fuel and winds and other technical data necessary for the successful flight of a commercial airliner, all the things the passengers never saw, assuming that the flight crew just showed up and turned it on as though it were a taxi cab.
Enjoy your sleep.
You bet, Captain. I dreamed of a hot day and a hot woman. Richter stood up, and his movements belied his supposed comfort.
I really am too old for this shit, the chief warrant officer thought.
It was just fate and luck, if you could call it that, that had put him on the mission. No one else had as much time on the Comanche as he and his fellow warrants did, and somebody had decided that they had the brains to do it without some goddamn colonel around to screw things up. And now he could boogie on out of here. He looked up to see a clear sky. Well, could be better. For getting in and getting out, better to have clouds.
Tanks are topped off. Some coffee would be nice, he thought aloud.
Here you go, Mr. Richter. It was Vega, the first sergeant. Nice iced coffee like they serve in the best Florida hotels.
Oh, thanks, loads, man.
Richter took the metal cup with a chuckle. Anything new on the way out? This was not good, Claggett thought. The Aegis line had broken up, and now he had one of the goddamn things 10 miles away. Worse still, there had been a helicopter in the air not long before, according to his ESM mast, which he'd briefly risked, despite the presence of the world's best surveillance radar. But three Army helicopters were depending on him to be here, and that was that. Nobody had ever told him that Harm's Way was a safe place. Not for him, not for them either.
"And our other friend?" he asked his sonar chief. The substantive reply was a shake of the head. The words merely confirmed it.
"Off the scope again."
There were 30 knots of surface wind, which was whipping up the waves somewhat and interfering with sonar performance. Even holding the destroyer was becoming difficult now that it was slowed to a patrol speed of no more than 15 knots. The submarine off to the north was gone again, maybe really gone, but it was dangerous to bank on that. Claggett checked his watch. He'd have to decide what to do in less than an hour. They would be going in blind, but that was an awkward necessity. Ordinarily, they'd get information with snooper aircraft, but the real effort here was to achieve surprise, and they couldn't compromise that. The carrier task force had avoided commercial air lanes, hidden under clouds, and generally worked very hard to make itself scarce for several days. Jackson felt confident that his presence was a secret, but maintaining it meant depending on spotty submarine reports of electronic activity on the islands, and all these did was to confirm that the enemy had several E-2C aircraft operating, plus a monster air defense radar. It would be an encounter battle aloft. Well, they'd been training for that over the past 2 weeks. Okay, last check, Oreza heard over the phone. Kobler is exclusively military aircraft? That is correct, sir, since the first couple of days we haven't seen any commercial birds on that runway. He really wanted to ask what the questions were all about, but knew it was a waste of time. Well, maybe an oblique question. You want us to stay awake tonight? Up to you, Master Chief. Now, can I talk to your guests? John? Phone, Portigee announced. Then he was struck nearly dumb by the normality of what he'd just said. Clark, Kelly said, taking it. Yes, sir. Yes, sir, will do. Anything else? Okay. Out. He hit the kill button. Whose idea was this friggin' umbrella? Mine, Burroughs said, looking up from the card table. It works, doesn't it? Sure as hell, John said, returning to the table and tossing a quarter in the pot. Call. Three ladies, the engineer announced. Lucky son of a gun, too, Clark said, tossing his in. Lucky hell. These sons of bitches ruined the best fishing trip I ever had. John, you want I should make some coffee for tonight? He makes the best damn coffee, too. Burroughs collected the pot. He was $6 ahead. Portigee, it has been a while. Sure, go ahead. It's called Black Gang coffee, Pete. Old seaman's tradition, Clark explained, also enjoying the pleasant inactivity. John? Ting asked. Later, my boy. He picked up the deck and started shuffling adeptly. It would wait. Sure you have enough fuel? Chega asked. The supplies that had been dropped in included auxiliary tanks and wings, but Richter shook his head. No prob, only 2 hours to the refueling point. Where's that? The signal over the SATCOM had said nothing more than proceed to primary, whatever that meant. About 2 hours away, the warrant officer said. Security, Captain, security. You realize we've made a little history here. Just so I live to tell somebody about it. Richter zipped up his flight suit, tucked in his scarf, and climbed aboard. Clear. The Rangers stood by one last time. They knew the extinguishers were worthless, but somebody had insisted on packing them along. One by one, the choppers lifted off, their green bodies soon disappearing into the darkness. With that, the Rangers started dumping the remaining equipment into holes dug during the day. That required an hour, and all that remained was their walk to Hirose. Cheka lifted his cellular phone and dialed the number he'd memorized. "Hello," a voice said in English. "See you in the morning, I hope?" The question was in Spanish. "I'll be there, señor." "Montoya, lead off," the captain ordered. They'd keep to the tree line as far as they could. The Rangers clasped weapons so far unused, hoping to keep it that way. "I recommend two weapons," Lieutenant Shaw said. "Spread the bearings about 10 degrees, converge them in from under the layer, and nail them fore and aft." "I like it." Claggett walked over to the plot for a final examination of the tactical situation. "Set it up." "So, what gives?" one of the army sergeants asked at the entrance to the attack center. "The trouble with these damn submarines was that you couldn't just hang around and watch stuff."
Before we can refuel those helos of yours, we have to make that can go away, a petty officer explained as lightly as he could.
Is it hard?
I guess we'd prefer he was someplace else. It puts us on the surface with...
Well, somebody's going to know there's somebody around.
Worried? Nah, the sailor lied. Then both men heard the captain speak.
Mr. Shaw, let's go to battle station's torpedo. Firing point procedures.
The Tomcats went off first, one every 30 seconds or so, until a full squadron of 12 was aloft. Next went four EA-6B jammers led by Commander Roberta Peach. Her flight of four broke up into elements of two, one to accompany each of the two probing Tomcat squadrons. Captain Bud Sanchez had the lead division of four, unwilling to entrust the attack of his air group to anyone else. They were 500 miles out, heading southwest. In many ways, the attack was a repeat of another action in the early days of 1991, but with a few nasty additions, occasioned by the few airfields available to the enemy and weeks of careful analysis of operational patterns. The Japanese were very regular in their patrols. It was a natural consequence of the orderliness of military life, and for that reason a dangerous trap to fall into. He gave one look back at the formation's sparkling wakes and then focused his mind on the mission.
Set 1 and 3.
Match generated bearings and shoot, Claggett said calmly. The weapons technician turned his handle all to the left, then back to the right, repeating the exercise for the second tube.
1 and 3 away, sir.
1 and 3, running normal, sonar reported an instant later.
Very well, Claggett acknowledged.
He had been aboard a submarine and heard those words before, and that shot had missed, to which fact he owed his life. This was tougher. They didn't have as good a feel for the location of the destroyer as they would have liked, but neither did he have much choice in the matter. The two ADCAPs would run slow under the layer for the first 6 miles before shifting to their highest speed setting, which was 71 knots. With luck, the target wouldn't have much chance to figure where the fish had come from.
Reload 1 and 3 with ADCAPs.
Timing, as always, was crucial. Jackson left the flag bridge after the fighters got off and headed below to the Combat Information Center, the better to coordinate an operation already figured out down to the minute. The next part was for his two Spruance destroyers, now 30 miles south of the carrier group. That made him nervous. The Spruances were his best ASW ships, and though SubPac reported that the enemy subscreen was withdrawing west, hopefully into a trap, he worried about the one SSK that might be left behind to cripple Pacific Fleet's last carrier deck. So many things to worry about, he thought, looking at the sweep hand on the bulkhead-mounted clock. Precisely at 11:45 local time, destroyers Cushing and Ingersoll turned broadside to the wind and began launching their Tomahawk missiles, signaling this fact by a five-element satellite transmission. A total of 40 cruise missiles angled up into the sky, shed their solid-fuel boosters, then angled down for the surface. After the 6-minute launch exercise, the destroyers increased speed to rejoin the battle group, wondering what their Tomahawks would accomplish.
"I wonder which one it is," Sato murmured.
They'd passed two already, the Aegis destroyers visible only from their wakes now, the barely visible arrowhead at the front of the spreading V of white foam.
"Call them up again. It will anger my brother. But it must be lonely down there."
Again Sato switched his radio setting, then depressed the switch on the wheel. JAL-747
flight calling Mutsu.
Admiral Sato wanted to grumble, but it was a friendly voice. He took the headset from the junior communications officer and closed his thumb on the switch.
"Torajiro, if you were an enemy, I would have you now."
He checked the radar display. Only commercial targets were on the 2-meter-square tactical display screen. The spy 1D radar showed everything within 100+ miles and most things out to nearly 300. The ship's SH-60J helicopter had just refueled for another anti-sub sweep, and though he was still at sea in time of war,
He could allow himself a joke with his brother flying up there in the big aluminum tub, doubtless filled with his countrymen.
"Time, sir," Shaw said, checking his electronic stopwatch. Commander Claggett nodded. "Webs, bring them up and go active."
The proper command went to the torpedoes, now nearly 2 miles apart on either side of the target. The ADCAP, Additional Capability version of the Mark 48, had a huge solid-state sonar system built into its 21-inch nose. The unit launched from Tube 1 was slightly closer, and its advanced imaging system acquired the destroyer's hull on the second sweep. Immediately, the torpedo turned right to home in, relaying its display to the launch point as it did so.
Hydrophone effects bearing 230, enemy torpedo bearing 230, a sonar officer shouted. Its seeker is active.
Sato's head turned sharply toward the sonar room, and instantly a new item appeared on the tactical display.
Damn, he thought, and Kuroshio said the area was safe. The SSK was only a few miles off.
Countermeasures, Mutsu's captain ordered at once.
In seconds, the destroyer streamed an American-designed Nixie decoy off her fantail.
Launch the helicopter at once.
Brother, I am somewhat busy now. Have a good flight. Goodbye for now.
The radio circuit went dead. Captain Sato wrote off the end of the conversation to the fact that his brother did have duties to perform. Then, before his eyes, he saw the destroyer 5 miles below him turn sharply to the left with more boiling foam at her stern to indicate a sudden increase in speed.
"Something's wrong here," he breathed over the intercom.
"We got him, sir, one or both," the fire controlman announced.
"Target is increasing speed and turning to starboard," sonar reported. "Both units are in acquisition and closing. Target isn't pinging anything yet."
"Unit 1 range to target is now 2,000 yards. Unit 3 is 2,200 out. Both units are tracking nicely, sir."
The petty officer's eyes were locked on the weapons display, ready to override a possible mistake made by the automated homing systems. The ADCAP was, at this point, not unlike a miniature submarine with its own very precise sonar picture, enabling the weapons tech to play vicarious kamikaze, in this case, two at once, a skill that nicely complemented his skill on the boat's Nintendo system.
The really good news for Claggett was that he wasn't trying a counter-detection, but rather trying to save his ship first.
Well, that was a judgment call, wasn't it?
"There's another one forward of us bearing 140.
"They have us," the captain said, looking at the display and thinking that probably two submarines had shot at him. Still, he had to try in order to crash turn to port.
Top-heavy, like her American Aegis cousins, Mutsu heeled violently to the right. As soon as the turn was made, the CO ordered full astern, hoping that the torpedo might miss forward.
It couldn't be anything else.
Sato was losing sight of the battle and overrode the autopilot, turning his aircraft into a tight left bank, leaving it to his right seater to hit the seatbelt signs for the passengers. He could see it all in the clear light of a quarter moon. Mutsu had executed one radical turn and then twisted into another. There were flashing lights on her stern as the ship's anti-sub helicopter started turning its rotor, struggling to get off and hunt whatever.
Yes, it had to be a submarine, Captain Sato thought, a sneaking, cowardly submarine attacking his brother's proud and beautiful destroyer.
He was surprised to see the ship slow, to stop almost dead with the astern thrust of a reversible propeller, and wondered why that maneuver had been attempted.
Wasn't it the same as for aircraft, whose rule was the simple axiom, speed is life?
"Major cavitation sounds, maybe a crash stop, sir," the sonar chief said. The weapons tech didn't give Claggett a chance to react.
"Don't matter. I have 'em cold on both, sir. Setting 3 for contact explosion, getting some magnetic interference from..."
"They must use our Nixie, eh?"
"Correct, sailor."
"Well, we know how that puppy works. Unit 1 is 500 out, closing fast."
The technician cut one of the wires, letting Unit 1 go on its own now, rising to 30 feet and fully autonomous, activating its onboard magnetic field and seeking the metal signature of the target, then finding it, letting it grow,
and grow. The helicopter just got off, its strobe lights looping away from the now stationary destroyer. The moment seemed fixed in time when the ship started turning again, or seemed to. Then a violent green flash appeared in the water on both sides of the ship, just forward of the bridge, under the vertical launch magazine for her surface-to-air missiles. The knife-like shape of the hull was backlit in an eerie, lethal way. The image fixed in Sato's mind for the quarter-second it lasted, and then one or more of the destroyer's SAMs exploded, followed by 40 others, and Mutsu's forward half disintegrated. 3 seconds later, another explosion took place, and when the white water returned back to the surface, there was little more to be seen than a patch of burning oil, just like her namesake in Nagasaki Harbor in 1943. "Captain," the co-pilot had to wrench the control wheel level away from the captain before the Boeing went into a stall. "Captain, we have passengers aboard." "That was my brother. We have passengers aboard, damn you." Without resistance now, he brought the 747 back to level flight, looking at his gyrocompass for the proper heading.
"Captain!"
Sato turned his head back into the cockpit, losing sight of his brother's grave, as the airliner changed its heading back to the south.
"I am so sorry, Captain Sato, but we also have a job we must do."
He engaged the autopilot before reaching out to the man.
"Are you all right now?"
Sato looked forward into the empty sky, then he nodded and composed himself.
"Yes, I am quite all right. Thank you. Yes, I am quite all right now," he repeated more firmly,
required by the rules of his culture to set his personal emotions aside for now. Their father had survived his destroyer command, had moved on to captain a cruiser on which he had died off Samar, the victim of American destroyers and their torpedoes. And now, again.
"What the hell was that?"
Commander Ugaki demanded of his sonar officer.
"Torpedoes, two of them from the south," the junior lieutenant replied. "They've killed Mutsu."
"What from?" was the next angry shout.
"Something undetected, Captain," was the weak reply.
"Come south, turns for 8 knots.
That will take us right through the disturbance from..."
"Yes, I know that." "Definite kill," sonar told him. The signature on the sonar screen was definite. No engine sounds from target bearing but breakup noises, and this here was one big secondary explosion. "We got him, sir." Richter crossed over the same town the C-17 had overflown a few days earlier, and though somebody might have heard him, that was less of a concern now. Besides, at night a chopper was a chopper, and there were plenty of them here. He settled his Comanche to a cruising altitude of 50 feet and headed due south, telling himself that sure the Navy would be there, and sure he could land on a ship, and sure everything was going to go just fine. He was grateful for the tailwind until he saw the waves it was whipping up. Oh, shit. "Mr. Ambassador, the situation has changed, as you know," Adler said gently. The room had never heard the sound of more than one voice, but somehow it seemed far quieter now. Seiji Nagumo, sitting next to his senior, noted that the chair next to Adler was occupied by someone else, another Japanese specialist from the fourth floor. Where was Chris Cook, he asked himself, as the American negotiator went on. Why was he not here? And what did it mean? "As we speak, American aircraft are attacking the Marianas. As we speak, American fleet units are engaging your fleet units. I must tell you that we have every reason to believe that our operations will be successful and that we will be able to isolate the Marianas from the rest of the world. The next part of the operation, if it becomes necessary, will be to declare a maritime exclusion zone around your home islands. We have no wish to attack your country directly, but it is within our capabilities to cut off your maritime trade in a matter of days."
Mr. Ambassador, it is time to put an end to this.
As you see, the CNN reporter said from her perch next to USS Enterprise. Then the camera panned to her right, showing an empty box.
USS John Stennis has left her dry dock. We are informed that the carrier is even now launching a strike against the Japanese-held Marianas. We were asked to cooperate with government deception operations, and after careful consideration, it was decided that CNN is, after all, an American news service.
Bastards, General Arima breathed, looking at the empty concrete structure occupied only by puddles and wooden blocks now. Then his phone rang.
When it was certain that the Japanese E-2Cs had them, two Air Force AWACS aircraft flipped their radars on, having staged in from Hawaii via Dias on Kwajalein Atoll. In electronic terms, it would be an even fight, but the Americans had more aircraft up to make sure it was fair in no other way. Four Japanese Eagles were aloft, and their first instinctive action was to turn northeast toward the intruders, the better to give their comrades standing ground alert time to get aloft and join the air battle before the incoming attack got close enough to catch their comrades on the ground. Simultaneously, the ground defenses were warned to expect inbound hostile aircraft. Sanchez lit off his own targeting radar as he saw the Japanese fighters just over 100 miles away, heading in to launch their missiles. But they were armed with AMRAAMs, and he was armed with Phoenix, which had about double the range. He and three other aircraft launched two each for a max-range engagement. The eight missiles went into ballistic arcs, heading up to 100,000 feet, before tipping over at Mach 5 and heading back down, their height giving them the largest possible radar cross-section to home on. The Eagles detected the attack and tried to maneuver clear, but seconds later, two of the F-15Js were blotted from the sky. The remaining pair kept driving on. The second wave of Phoenixes took care of that.
"What the hell?" Areza wondered.
The sound of many jet engines starting up interrupted the card game, and all four men in the room went to the windows. Clark remembered to turn all the lights out and stole the only set of binoculars in the house. The first pair of aircraft blazed off Kobler Field just as he brought them to his eyes. They were single-engine aircraft, judging by their afterburner flames.
"What's happening, John?"
"Nobody told me, really, but it shouldn't be too hard to figure out. Lights were on all over the field. What mattered was getting the fighters off as rapidly as possible. The same thing would be happening on Guam, probably, but Guam was a good ways off, and the two fighter groups would be engaging the Americans separately, negating the Japanese numerical advantage."
"What are those?"
Commander Peach and her jammers were also at work now. The search radar was powerful, but like all of its type, it also transmitted low-frequency waves, and those were easily jammed. The massive collection of false dots both confused their understanding of the developing air action and knocked back their ability to detect the small but unstealthy cruise missiles. Fighters that might have tried to engage them had in fact overrun the inbound targets, giving them a free advance to the island's targets. The search radar atop Mount Takpochao picked them up barely 30 miles out instead of the Hope 400, and was also trying to get a count on the inbound fighters. That gave the three operators on the set a complex task, but they were trained men, and they bent to the demands of the moment, one of their number sounding the alarm to get the island's Patriot missile batteries alerted. The first part of the operation was going well. The standing combat air patrol had been eliminated without loss, Sanchez saw, wondering if it had been one of his missiles that scored. No one would ever know about that. The next task was to take out the Japanese radar aircraft before the rest of their fighters arrived. To accomplish that, a division of four Tomcats went to burner and rocketed straight for them, rippling off all their missiles for the task. They were just too brave for their own good, Sanchez saw. The Japanese Hawkeyes should have pulled back, and the defending Eagles should have done the same. But true to the fighter pilot's ethos, they'd come out to engage the first wave of raiders instead of waiting. Probably because they thought this was a genuine raid instead of a mere fighter sweep. The flanking division of four, called Blinder Flight,
fulfilled its limited mission of killing the airborne radar birds, then turned back to John Stennis to refuel and rearm. Now the only airborne radar was American. The Japanese came on, trying to blunt the attack that really did not exist, seeking to engage targets whose only goal had been the attention of the outbound interceptor.